And welcome to another fun-filled episode of that 401k podcast. Ari Rosenbaum here. Our topic for this week is dealing with plan sponsors and organization. And, you know, some of the problems that, you know, kind of gets neglected when dealing with clients and, you know, situations that may pop up from time to time. Of course, this is part of the broadcast where I got to shill for my events. Listen. These rear ends and seats don't, you know, the seats don't fill up with rear ends all by itself. So, of course, as you listen to this broadcast week to week, that 401k National Conference is pretty soon, March 10th to 11th. Before we know it, we're going to be there. And it's going to be Walt Disney World Swan. Goose Gossage is one of our, you know, as you know, he booked as a guest for game day two. Day one, we'll have a guest as well. You know, some great presentations dealing with the Secure Act, multiple employer plans, hopefully, as well as the Retireholics will be there to record an episode with yours truly. Trying to figure out the beer that we're going to use. Probably leaning towards Sam Adams. I don't want to get anything too regional from New York because I don't want to bring it with me on the plane or in my luggage. And, you know, the last thing I need is, you know, remnants of bottled beer all over my luggage. I don't drink aluminum canned beer. To me, beer belongs either from tap, preferably in a bottle, never in a can. It just tastes like metal. It just doesn't seem right. I remember one of the last times I had canned beer. Mets won the NL East in 2015, and I was going in that night for a sleep study, drinking an aluminum can of Samuel Adams Oktoberfest, and you can tell the difference, but that's neither here nor there. Other people will be there. Wolf Prime will be there. This is a website, software company that you've never heard of before. You will hear them because they have a really exciting plan prospecting tool that is really going to change the way, if you're an advisor to prospect clients dealing with plan design issues and whatnot. It's fantastic. Franklin Templeton will be there. Lincoln Financial will be there. You know, we have a growing list of speakers. We're adding the agenda every day or every other day. Alan Gross from, was it GSM Marketing, is going to have a great presentation on helping build your business. It's going to be a lot of fun. You have discount Walt Disney World passes available to purchase. You have opportunity to stay at the Walt Disney World Swan at a discounted rate. It's going to be a lot of fun, a lot of, you know, interesting differences between other national events. You know, a lot of the national events are obviously going to be better attended. They have better marketing budgets, and they've been here, been around longer than my events. But, you know, sometimes you feel like a herd, you know, part of a cattle. It's a cattle call. You know, with my events, you certainly don't. You get the attention. You get to network a lot. It's a lot of fun. And, of course, the regional events will be back. Strong interest, especially in St. Louis, which is in May. I got people signing up for that as well. Houston will be April 17th, which should be a lot of fun at the home of the, I guess as it stands now, the Houston Astros. We'll be there April 17th. We'll have a game that night against the Angels. We'll see who they name as their manager. By the time this episode drops, they probably will have selected somebody. And I'm sure that will be part of the discussion. It's kind of embarrassing to get caught up in like that. Of course, what's funny is my Mets just part ways with their manager. The Mets had nothing to do with this cheating scandal, but yet, of course, being the Mets that they are, they always have to get implicated there some way or another. They have to hire the person who was at the time he got the job, was tainted by this cheating scandal, and obviously, of course, got implicated as one of the ringleaders. So we got those two events. St. Louis will have a game against the Mets May 8th. And then rounding out the spring, June the 5th, will be in Minneapolis, Minnesota, which is going to be a lot of fun, Target Field. Go to that 401ksite.com for further information. Thank you. And going to today's topic, organization. Dealing with plan sponsors, their organization, and most of the time, the lack of organization. I think this article is kind of relevant, or this topic is kind of relevant, because we're dealing, you know, the month of January, and if you ever go to Target, Target to me is a big example, or even Costco. As soon as 12/31 rolls around, all that holiday stuff goes bye-bye, you know, back to wherever, you know, excess items go to. And they get replaced by, especially Target, bins, storage bins, you know, weight loss type products, but mostly a lot of storage. It's all about New Year's resolutions. And of course, most of us don't keep our New Year's resolutions. I tend not to make any. The only time I think I made one that I actually followed through is when I was in high school and I lost 45 pounds. I don't make them. But a lot of people do. And of course, one at the top of the list, besides losing weight, is organization. Be organized. And, you know, it's easier said than done. As someone who's on their own and I've been trying to be organized, and, you know, especially with, you know, scraps of paper here and there, sometimes, you know, you're organized and sometimes you fall off the wagon. That's a problem. And, you know, there's stores for that. I mean, to me, I find the Container Store fascinating. I wonder sometimes when people use the Container Store how much they purchase and they actually use. But the Container Store is very, very fascinating because of all the different storage products that they have. I had my closet in my office built, essentially put together at the Container Store. You know, you just buy their, was it Alpha pieces, and, you know, you could buy, build carts, and I've had to build carts. And believe me, building stuff that's made by the Container Store or sold through the Container Store is a lot easier to build than something from IKEA. When we moved to our house, or actually, I think when we when I first got married and we had an apartment in Queens, everything was IKEA. I felt, you know what, we'll be here for a couple years, we'll buy a house, let's buy temporary furniture. And of course, building IKEA furniture is to me one of my least favorite things. It's just, it's poorly made, in my opinion. You miss a nail, you break it. I mean, you just, the instructions aren't very good. And, you know, I'm glad to say my wife survived that because, you know, building things together, I don't know what the divorce rate are of people who build IKEA products together. I want to say it's quite high. Luckily, we decided at a very early point in our marriage that when it came to IKEA building, I was left to build it on my own. And unfortunately, sometimes very well, sometimes not. I think there was one time we had our dresser that we eventually gave to the nanny when we moved to our house in Oceanside. It literally was splitting apart. It was like, there was like a middle of the drawer that it built together, and it literally was like splitting apart. It was hilarious. But anyway, organization is a big key for plan sponsors. And I think as a plan provider, that's something that we forget about. We don't consider it. And plan organization is really an important tool, and it's an important thing to stress to your plan sponsor clients, especially when you're hired from the get-go. When you have existing plan sponsor clients for years, the fact that you are a fiduciary of a plan means that there's a good chance that they're on the path towards being organized. I know advisors who, you know, create these fancy binders with, you know, tools and plan documents and stuff that a plan sponsor needs. Or, you know, back in the old days when I used to write initially, I used to call it the football, meaning, you know, football is a code term for the briefcase that has nuclear codes. And I always said the plan sponsors need their own football, which would be the plan documents, IPS, minute meetings, you know, meetings of minutes, meetings of minutes, minutes of meetings, and, you know, have that just in case there's an audit. And, you know, plan sponsors really need to understand that when it comes to their plan, they can't be a slob and lose things. They have to be organized because, you know, keeping good plan records and being organized falls under their fiduciary duty, especially the fiduciary duty of prudence, in my opinion. And they really have a responsibility to plan participants, and they need to be organized because the fact of the matter is that missing records and documents are going to threaten the tax qualification of their plan. Plans have been disqualified for various reasons. If they, you know, plan sponsor doesn't have updated plane documents since 1986 or 89, because I think that's when the 86 plans went into effect. You know, that's a problem. And, you know, the problem with, you know, again, missing plane documents is there's always a question whether the plan sponsor drafted them or not. And the IRS and the DOL have this rebuttable presumption that if the plane document is missing, that means it was never done. And that's not a rebuttable presumption. That is a presumption that's there. And unless you can produce the plane documents, the IRS will say, especially the IRS will say, you know what, we got a problem here. You got to go through a audit cap process, update, you know, put in a new plane document, or, you know, if it's really egregious, disqualify the plan. Of course, you know, I think disqualifying the plan is very unlikely, but it has happened for really egregious, you know, problems. So, you know, one thing that, you know, obviously plan sponsors need to keep organized with is, like I said, plan documents. Plan sponsors need to understand that while there are certain records they can throw out after a period of time, plan documents aren't one of them. Plan documents, some plan descriptions, don't throw them out. They need to be told that. Because, again, plan has been in place for, you know, 20, 30 years. Fact of matter is that there is time to time that the IRS might ask for it. And you just can't tell them, no, we tossed it, we don't have it. They don't like to hear that. You know, plan sponsors need to understand that while they, you know, restate their plan document every 6 years and add a tack on amendment every 2 to 3 years, depending on the tax laws, they need to keep copies of it all the time. And it's extremely important that they do that. And, you know, and I, as I said, I've had plan sponsors get into trouble because, you know, there was the issue of, you know, auditor saying, you know what, where's your plan document? Where's your extra restatement? Plan sponsor says, we did it, but we don't have a copy of it. So the IRS says, you know what, in our mind, you didn't do it. So here's a penalty. You got to fix this through audit cap, and here's the penalty amount. And another reason to keep all copies of the plan documents, one of the reasons is because you need to have it, you know, it's kind of like if you ever heard the story of how the Torah or the Old Testament was created. It was created orally. Generation from generation would recite the Torah, and then eventually at one point they would write it down. So the question I always have sometimes is, were there mistakes made along the way in transcribing the oral Torah? In the same cases with plain documents, they're obviously not, you know, the Bible. For a risk attorney, they're the Bible, you know, in some instances of plan administration. But from time to time, changes are made and mistakes are made. So, you know, while a plan document could have said, you know, 6 months or some type of vesting schedule and it was changed along the way and it's incorrect, you know, that's a problem. And so the fact of the matter is that you need to keep a track of all your plan documents, because there was a time, I remember many years ago, where I was a lowly associate in a lowly law firm, and I had the unenviable task of going through a union's pension plan and looking through the original 1976 plan document and determining that there were some mistakes made along the way and had to be fixed. And so we had to use the 1976 plan document as a historical basis to try to fix some of the provisions that got screwed up along the way. I mean, that's a fact. And so it's really important that you have a plan sponsor keep all plan documents and, you know, make sure that they have it just in case. Just in case of plan audit, just in case of plan reviews, whatever it may be. Next thing on my list, dealing with organization or committees. It's important that a plan sponsor not have one person who makes all the decisions. They need to have a committee in place, an apparatus, a decision-making body that will make, obviously, the decisions for the plan, whether it's, you know, retaining a 338 advisor, hiring one, you know, approving the fund selection or the fund selection advice provided by the 321 advisor, whatever it may be. But it's important that one person just doesn't make the decisions, that you actually have a committee in place. And, you know, the problem, you know, with a committee is that you actually have to create one, and it's all part of a process. You actually create a process and follow the process. Do your job. Follow the process. That's an amalgamation of the Patriots, Bill Belichick motto, and the Philadelphia 76ers, trust the process. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, you have to have a committee, set one up, have meetings, take minutes of these meetings. And, you know, like I said, setting up a process isn't important as following the process. You set up a process, you don't follow it, it would be considered a breach in any good court of law. The problem with committees, I find sometimes, is that the all of a sudden they make the committee a bureaucracy. I worked at a law firm, and I'm, you know, I think it's 2020 now. I will say that law firm is Meyer Swazi English and Klein. I used to joke, the semi-prestigious law firm in Long Island. And when I was an associate, I was very much interested in social media. So the managing attorney, her name was Lois, didn't really care about social media. I used to joke that her husband had his own practice in Lynbrook, where he was a divorce attorney or, you know, family relations law, and he would do a lot of social media. And the way she looked down upon it, you know, the way she was talking, you could get like she really looked down upon it. And I used to jokingly say the way she looked at social media for attorneys, she acted as if I was selling fish out of my trunk, my car trunk, which people on Long Island do for some reason. On Sunrise Highway in Valley Stream / Rosedale, and I've seen it at 110 where people are selling lobster tails and other, I've seen fruits and vegetables. I don't care. I'm not buying food out of somebody's trunk. I don't know where that trunk has been. I don't know where that food has been. But anyway, yeah, I was getting on her case about social media. She says, you know what? I'm going to create a committee for it. And, of course, who did she put on the social media committee? Not the two associates who were very good at social media. She put on the advertising guy, the law firm partner was on the advertising committee who never drew a dime of business and didn't know anything about advertising, didn't know anything about social media. And she put on the our computer guy who wasn't a lawyer. And I don't know whatever happened with that committee. And so my joke with Lois was always if she wanted to stifle something, she wanted to slow it down or eliminate the call for something, she would just create a committee for it. And I, you know, you see that from time to time. Even my synagogue, they had a lot of committees, and it's just like they talk, they don't do. And so the important part is that any committee that you set up for your plan sponsors, that it can't serve as a bureaucracy. It can't, you know, serve as a roadblock. It is a tool. It is a tool to facilitate good fiduciary practices, good fiduciary decision making, a prudent process. And when it becomes, you know, when you have too many people on the committee, too many people with hidden agendas, it only hurts the process. So yeah, it's great to be organized and have a committee, but I've seen from time to time, you know, working organizations, you know, my old synagogue, geez, if you want to get, you know, my joke was always, if you don't want something done, you know, have a committee for it. And that I thank Lois for that. And, of course, Lois, she always won these, like, CEO of the Year type awards. And under her leadership, the firm is about half the size since I left. And she's no longer, I think she's now of counsel of the firm. But I always have to bring that up. You know, it's part of the process. It's got to be followed. Take good, you know, the minutes of the meetings have to be correct. Talk about discussion, talk about decisions that were made. Attach any of the presentations and any of the information that was made and put it with the minutes. Of course, another thing that's really important to handle are plan valuation reports, Form 5500s, payroll records, and distributions. Of course, we live in a time of eFast and electronic filing of Form 5500. It's easy to access the latest 5500s if you don't have a copy, the plan sponsor doesn't have a copy. But, you know, I think it's important to have that somewhere, especially some of the older ones that predate electronic filing. I don't think that some of the databases have, going back at a certain point. It's important for the plan sponsor to have plan valuation reports. I cannot stress that enough. And the reason I can't stress enough is because, we're all victims of our own circumstance, and we are all victims of our prior experiences in somewhat. And one of the ones that always bothers me to this day was when I first started out, I was contacted by an actuary who recommended me to a client. Department of Labor was looking at their defined benefit plan because some people were excluded by name back when people thought that you could do that, which you can't. It's not a reasonable classification. So the Department of Labor was investigating it, and the actuary conveniently died. I say conveniently died because we found out through the Department of Labor investigation that the plan sponsor didn't have any copies of any plan evaluation reports. We don't know if the actuary ever did it, and I later found out that the actuary lost his accreditation. As an actuary, he was that good. He passed away. Plan sponsors, no records, and one of the stupidest pieces of advice that the actuary gave this poor woman who was the owner of this company was, since the benefits, the bulk of the benefits in the defined medical plan belong to the wife, the owner of the company, it was a husband and wife, since it belonged to them, he said that it was perfectly fine for the defined benefit plan to write a check to another affiliated company to represent her benefit. So Department of Labor says, listen, I don't see any plan evaluation reports, and all I see is a check from the plan to an affiliated company. That's a verbiage transaction. You are embezzling. We're going to sue you. We're going to sue you for $3 million. I'm not a litigator. That was the last time I ever was in court. I was sitting with her litigation counsel. And that's one of the last times I saw her, because the fact of the matter is that she decided to bring in these litigators that she used in the past. I believed that they should settle with the Department of Labor, see where they can move with. And the litigator, who was really only interested, apparently, in driving up legal costs, says, no, we're going to fight it. And many years have passed, and I just decided about a year ago, I wonder whatever happened to her. So I Googled her name and the name of the company, and lo and behold, after about 3 years of litigation, I see a press release where the Department of Labor came to an agreement where she was going to fork over the $3 million that they were demanding 3 years earlier, and then she would have to relinquish her spot as a plan fiduciary, and, litigator got paid. She got hurt financially badly, but she took poor legal advice. She got poor advice from a plan provider, the actuary. So again, plan valuation reports, which show you the account balances, discrimination testing, the census, plan provisions. Keep those. Plan sponsors are advised that ERISA records should only be kept for 7 years. But in my opinion, when it comes to plan distributions, that's something that should be kept for good. And quite honestly, I wouldn't throw out anything related to the plan, as long as you scan everything. Back in the old days when you had file rooms and you need space, I think, what's great for a plan sponsor is, scan everything, keep it on the system, and voila, it's there when you need it. And so it doesn't take up the space. Distributions, the reason I always say I never want to throw out that information is because on the pension plan side, I've known from years, you'd have a participant who thinks they were owed a benefit and they weren't, and or somebody claims that, they weren't paid out when they were. To me, throwing that kind of stuff out, distribution records, and valuation reports. These are things I would just never toss. Especially when you have this scanning system and you could scan it easily and not have paper copies of these things. I think that's extremely important. That's just my take. I've seen too many crazy things. You know, I'll never forget the union plan where, you know, a participant claims somebody, you know, cashed their distribution check, and, you know, we got video cameras of the check cashing plays, and voila, it was a participant cashing their own distribution check. So you'd be surprised what happens. People will come up with some crazy stories, and, you know, good practices kind of root these out, you know, root these bad stories out. So, like I said, I wouldn't throw anything out as long as you scan it. They don't take it. They don't take as much space on a network drive than they do in the filing cabinet. Next thing I think that, you know, plan sponsors that you work with need to realize is that they need to distribute required ERISA notices. You know, summary plan description when a plan's been restated, summary plan description when a participant becomes eligible, enrollment forms, beneficiary forms, summary annual reports, the annual vesting slash account balance information, the fee disclosure, whatever it may be. Important that the plan sponsors organize, distributes the notices. Of course, as we know, there are penalties involved if there's, you know, the summary annual report is not furnished in a quick manner. You know, obviously the e-disclosure push by the Department of Labor is going to help rectify this situation in terms of distributing paper, if we could distribute it online through email. So hopefully that will save a lot of trees. Save a lot of headache of dealing with return mail and all that kind of stuff. Another thing that plan sponsors really need to be organized is dealing with fee disclosures. Plan sponsors, you know, back in the day, prior to 2012, when we didn't have fee disclosure, plan sponsors had a fiduciary duty to pay only reasonable plan expenses, and that was a problem when they had no idea what they were being charged. And now they know. They've been knowing now it's going to be 8 years in June, July. They know. They can't pretend they don't know. They know. They got the disclosure. The problem with most plan sponsors, they never benchmark the fees. They don't understand that they actually, you know, this isn't like a menu where, you know, this is something that they actually have to follow through and, you know, select, you know, the providers, you know, benchmark the fees, select providers if the benchmarking shows that they're paying too much money. It's important that plan sponsors realize that they just can't put in the back of the drawer or put in the trash. Last but not least, one thing that I know, I want to say a super majority of plan sponsors probably don't do, and that's keeping records of plan enrollment and education meetings. I don't know. I just, when you have a meeting, have an attendance sheet. You know, when I think of a, you know, just a sign-in sheet, I think it's important when you have a plan enrollment education meeting, keep records of, you know, the advertising that you did with it, you know, email list if you emailed plan participants about the enrollment slash education meeting. Keep copies. They need to keep copies of all the, you know, different little, all the different little handouts that were given, plan education materials, that sort of thing. And keep a record of it. And, of course, the sign-in sheet, which always reminds me. For some reason, I always get a chuckle. When I think of a sign-in sheet, I think of a loose leaf paper and people signing in. And I just remember that goes back to my time in Millbridge High School when we had a substitute teacher. And they'd be like, you'd have to sign in just to make sure that you don't get charged with a cut, which would be like 5 points off your grade point, 5 points of your grade in the class. And, you know, when you're a freshman or a sophomore in high school, you want to make sure that you signed in and you don't get in trouble. You know, people who are juniors and seniors would just, not me, but a lot of juniors or seniors would use that time to goof off. They'd ask their friends to sign in for them, and they would just, like, leave and cut class. But my favorite part was, it was in high school Latin, I think it was, which was always funny. I was a junior in high school that year. Yeah, I was. And it was a class being taught by a teacher who I just didn't like. I think She was very, very young. She must have been in her late 20s. And I was a teenager, of course. I didn't like her. I thought she was too friendly with the students. And, of course, I was right. I learned about a year or so after I graduated, she left her husband for a student, which I think was totally legal because I think he was eventually 18, whatever it is. So, anyway, she was absent, and the substitute did the sign-in sheet. And, you know, that was the time people would, like, put in, like, fake names, kind of like a Howard Stern funny phone call. And I'll never forget my sense of humor. It just shows you how sometimes I have an infantile sense of humor, but I still think it's hilarious. And the substitute's just deciding to read names to make sure that there's nobody signing in who just had their friend sign in who wasn't there, so she's reading it. And she reads, like, Superman. So, you know, obviously Superman or Clark Kent weren't there for the class. But then the next time she's like, Max E. Pad. And I just, like, the whole class started laughing. I mean, it's 30 years later. I'm still laughing about it. I don't know why. I just find it funny that somebody would read the name out loud without realizing that it was a phony name and whatever. So I'm going to leave the episode on that with a old Midwood High School story from 1989. And hopefully I didn't scare you guys away, and you'll hear from me next week. Of course, like I said, go to that401ksite.com for further information on that 401k National Conference and that 401k Conference. So long. Take care. Bye.